Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. Let's go to the show. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other public health crises. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I want to ask you about a news development that I'm not sure is a news development. One of our listeners forwarded what is, I think, a well-written press release from the University of Washington, talking about the fact that a research team at their Institute for Protein Design has a vaccine broadly targeting a subset of coronaviruses, sarbecoviruses. So this would include COVID, but also SARS and MERS, entering phase two trials in Perth, Australia. And I know there has been a lot of hope in some kind of pan-coronavirus vaccine for a long time that would, you know, retain its efficacy even as the COVID-19 virus mutates and spins off new variants. And I guess my question is, because I'm looking at something that is clearly publicity materials, is this at the point where it's something worth paying attention to and getting excited about, or is it not that?
That's a hard answer to question to answer. when I read about things like this, I get really excited, not because it means that something is imminent, but it's because people are still knocking at this door. And this is the door that you and I have wanted to open for a long time and talked about, and that is a universal vaccine for coronaviruses. And there's been a long history now of trying to find a universal vaccine for the influenza viruses. Both of these viruses present similar challenges, and you mentioned it. They change, they mutate. And every time they mutate, we have to create another vaccine. I can't speak to this specific study in Washington, at the University of Washington, that's going on in Perth. I can speak to something similar that was reported about 10 days ago or so with the influenza vaccine, where there's a lot of enthusiasm in regards to maybe finding a key to unlock this door. We're hopeful, and hope is critical for us to get excited about. But it's right now, it remains at the level of hope. But, you know, Brian, I just, in seeing what's been done over the last very few years, particularly sped up by the COVID pandemic, I really think we're going to be able to open that door and have vaccines in the not too distant future that can give us not only broader coverage, but also coverage of greater duration, so that we can get a vaccine that lasts much longer. For example, the RSV vaccine is good for at least 3 years, maybe longer, whereas the COVID vaccine and the influenza vaccine are good for months. So that's my answer to that.
So the principle here, as I understand it, is these vaccines that are swiftly outpaced by new variants are often educating the immune system on how to recognize and respond to the portion of the virus that mutates. In the case of the coronavirus, it's the spike protein. And that a more broadly useful vaccine might educate the immune system on how to see and respond to a different, more stable part of the virus's structure. Like, I'm getting out of my depth here. The nucleocapsid is what I have read. Is that like a good layperson's understanding of the tree that researchers are barking up?
It is. There's one other piece to that, and that is, not only do we have to develop vaccines against a portion of the virus that is stable, that doesn't change, is highly, what we call highly conserved. But our immune response to that portion has to be protective. That is, we can develop antibodies to all, to multiple parts of the coronavirus, coronaviruses or the influenza viruses, but a lot of those antibodies don't offer us protection because they're directed at a part of the virus that an immune response to that doesn't really protect us. So that's really the stumbling block, or a big part of the stumbling block. And that is to find a portion of the virus that is highly conserved, that is stable, that if we develop an immune response to it, it will offer protection.
Which doesn't seem to speak to the other limitation we've run into with COVID vaccines, which is just that totally separate from any mutation of the virus, their efficacy wanes over time as the body's production of antibodies kind of slowly tapers off. Is that something that can be addressed through vaccine design?
I think so. And I think that it's not only that the antibodies taper off, we don't want a lot of antibodies going on for years, but we want our immune system to have the ability to respond very rapidly when encountered with something it's familiar with. It's also important to know that our immune system has different territories that it surveys and protects us, uses for protection. That is, we have some antibodies that are in the system, that is in the bloodstream primarily. And we have some antibodies that are primarily on what are called the mucosal surfaces. That is, like the lining of the nose, the lining of the eye, the lining of the airways. And so it's not only that we need to stimulate just antibodies in general, we need to stimulate specific antibodies. We need, for protection against infection, we really need those antibodies that are on the mucosal surface. For protection against systemic disease, generalized inflammation that you and I have talked a lot about, we need antibodies circulating in the bloodstream. So, still lots of challenges here. But there's one very big challenge, and that is that vaccines don't help anybody. They don't protect anybody. It's vaccination that protects people. And we can create the greatest vaccines in the world, and as long as we have people in Washington, D.C., like the person in charge of HHS, we're seeing the number of people electing to get vaccinated decline. And of course, as you and I have discussed so much, we're seeing the consequences of that already with all these measles cases as one example, whooping cough cases as another example, and so on. And the advisory committee to the CDC is meeting on the 25th of this month for a couple of days. And I'm afraid that we're going to hear some more utter nonsense out of that committee, as a politically planned, ideologically planned attack, further attack on vaccination.
Speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg, he's clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health, and he is here to answer your questions. 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. Dr. Swartzberg, we'll start with a couple from the inbox while our phone lines are filling up. Our first comes from Alice in Richmond, who writes, "I'm over 65 and in good health. I've had COVID vaccines on schedule, as suggested. Since COVID is not very prevalent now, and I do not have any travel plans in the next few weeks, should I wait for my next booster until I am going to travel or attend a large gathering in order to have maximum protection for that?" And she's proposing this as an alternative to having it exactly 6 months after her last shot. What advice do we have for Alice?
It's a great question. There's no quote right or wrong answer to this, but her point is really worth considering, and that is that the ingredients that go into making a decision about when to get your booster are not just that, well, we know that at 4 months, immunity is significantly waned, and by 6 months, you really should get a booster if you're at high risk. And Alice is in a high risk group because of her age. On the other hand, Alice argues, or at least suggests, that, you know, COVID's really low right now, and it is really low right now. She's absolutely right. And if she's not going to be doing things that put her at significant risk, why not wait a little longer? It's perfectly reasonable. I think it's perfectly reasonable to consider that. Build it around a particular occasion that may be coming up in 7 months or 8 months as opposed to 6 months. Build it around a trip that you might be taking in 7 or 8 or 9 months, so you'll have maximum protection at that time. So the guidelines that we have are for populations, large populations, and they make sense for large populations. But when you reduce that to the individual, there's much more nuance. And Alice has brought up some of this nuance.
So I know in response to questions that have come our way from listeners before, you have said when it comes to getting shots early, like 4 months out from your last shot, that waiting a little bit longer, spacing the shots out more, can lead to a better immune response to the shot. That this is something to enter the balancing act you just described.
It is.
Does waiting after 6 months help in the same way? Like, at what point does increasing the interval between shots lose any discernible boost to the body's response?
Right. It's a great question. We have really good data at when it's close to the last time you got the vaccine. So within 2 months, you don't get as good an immune response with the booster. 3 months, not quite as good. 4 months, not quite as good. But our data after 4 months seems is really drifted off. There's not much difference between 4 months and 6 months. There is a little bit, but not much difference. After 6 months, we do see a significantly better response. So that's another thing to put in the calculus. But it has to be tempered by your risks. If you're immunocompromised, and a case of COVID could really be devastating, then you may need to get it. If you're severely immunocompromised, you may need to get it in 3 months. Even 2 months could be given. And you do get protection. It's just that it's not as robust. So I think we now have timing based upon what your risks are. We now have timing. The point you made, Mike, is that we have timing in regards to how well of an immune response are we going to get. And so you sort of put all these things together. And frankly, I don't think, well, what I would suggest our listeners do is talk to their doctors about that. Say, I've been thinking about getting a COVID vaccine later than 6 months or earlier than 6 months. And here are the things I'm thinking about. What do you think?
All right. 1-800-958-9008 to put your question to Dr. Swartzberg. 1-800-958-9008. Let's start in the North Bay with John. Good morning.
Oh, hi. And thanks to KPFA for keeping going. Thank you. My first question is, what about TB? Is there a vaccine? Is there a way to prevent it? And then my comment is, it seems like the administration is setting us up for another major pandemic. They kind of don't talk about the million people that died of COVID. Well, okay, and keep going. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Tuberculosis is the question, Dr. Swartzberg. What do we right. have by way means of prevention?
Well, as I think most of the list your listeners know, we had an outbreak at Reardon High School in San Francisco, pretty large outbreak. And it's just a reminder that TB has not gone away. When I was in training, I went to a tuberculosis conference with all the top epidemiologists in the country, talking about how this was in the 1970s, how by the year 2000, tuberculosis was going to be eliminated from the United States. And unfortunately, that prediction was completely wrong. It was based upon all the modeling we had at the time, but it was completely wrong. Tuberculosis remains a very formidable problem internationally, but also here in the United States, as we saw with the San Francisco High School outbreak. There's no good vaccine for tuberculosis. There is a vaccine for it that can prevent the bacterium spreading to certain parts of the body, like the brain. But it's not a great vaccine. We don't use it here for a variety of what I consider to be very good reasons. But it is available internationally, particularly in very high-risk groups. We need a very effective vaccine. But the bacterium that causes tuberculosis is quite formidable in terms of developing a vaccine against it, because our immune response to that bacterium is inadequate, and that's why so many people get tuberculosis. And John had another point that's really important to think about, and that is, are we being really set up for another pandemic? And the answer is absolutely yes. We've had three pandemics in the 21st century. We had three pandemics in the 20th century. So we are at significant risk of having another pandemic. I think that's inevitable. And the US government has done everything it can to make us at greater risk for that pandemic occurring, and for a greater risk of having a terrible response to the pandemic. One example, the Pandemic Preparedness Office, part of the executive branch, was set up by the US Congress and paid for by the US Congress. I think it was 2022. Might have been a year before that or a year after. I think it was 2022. And that office currently sits vacant. There's no chair for that committee. There are no members of that committee. Congress has allocated the money for it, and there's a law in place saying we have to have this office. It essentially doesn't exist. And this is just one of so many examples of how we're ill prepared for a future pandemic.
All right, to the West Bay for our next caller. Mike is on the line in San Francisco. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. So my question is about trying to reverse the effects of the whole anti-vax movement, and with anti-smoking, the public health researchers discovered that commercials and ads that tried to tell people how dangerous smoking was were not very effective, and what was most effective was telling people how they're being manipulated by big tobacco. And I'm wondering if there's anything parallel to that happening to counter the anti-vax movement.
Dr.
Mike, you
Schwartzberg?
ask, yeah, Mike, you ask a great question. We really know what to do in terms of communicating to the public about the misinformation and disinformation regarding vaccines. We've identified the people who are manipulating the American population. We've identified how much money they make. All of this is out there. What we don't have is a US government that uses our knowledge about how to communicate to the public about vaccines and to help the public identify the canards that are really purported upon them. But of course, our government is doing the opposite. So this is one of these areas where more research would be, of course, helpful, but we really know what to do. It's just that we don't have a government that's willing to do it. And to the converse, we have a government that is spreading misinformation and disinformation. So a change in government, using our current knowledge about public health communication, which is so much better than it was than at the start of the COVID pandemic, I think we really could pretty quickly turn around this anti-vax movement.
It also seems to me there's kind of some deeper systemic things to address, right? Like the drop in smoking rates in the U.S., this wasn't strictly good communication. It's also a policy framework. Smoking got banned in bars, and it got banned in restaurants, and then it got banned within a certain number of feet of windows and doors. And basically, the demonstration effect of seeing other people smoke and it be socially acceptable just got kind of taken off the board as a consequence of those public health policies, which were grounded in very good research about secondhand smoke. There's not an easy equivalent for that with COVID. But one thing I think about a lot is that people tend to have much more trust in medical advice when they have a regular relationship with a primary health provider, you know, someone they see repeatedly on a regular basis to talk about whatever comes up with their health, who can discuss it with them. And that because of, you know, the incredibly tangled American healthcare system, a lot of people don't have that basic touchstone to good health information.
What a terrific point. You're absolutely right. As you were talking, I was thinking about the fact that people who have their own doctor often don't have time. The doctor often doesn't have time right now to spend a lot of time talking about vaccines. Most doctors will be happy to do that, but there's so little time available. And then, of course, there's so many people that don't have a primary care physician or primary care health provider. So they don't really have access to that. And you're absolutely right about the fact that when every poll I've seen over the last quite a few years shows that the most trusted person in terms of giving you advice is your healthcare provider. But we have a system of healthcare delivery in this country that relegates an awful lot of people to either not having a healthcare provider or to going to see a healthcare provider that is just overwhelmed. So, formidable problems in regards to that. You're right, Mike. Brian.
I'm not sure we can squeeze in another caller. Let's pluck one more from the inbox that is hopefully simple. Dave in San Jose says that he is in the cohort of children who likely received the less long-lasting vaccine for measles. This is people who were vaccinated between 1963 and 1967 for measles, got an old version of the vaccine. He writes, I asked my doctor about an immunity test, and the doctor said, just get an MMR shot. I got an MMR shot and was told that one shot was good enough, since it would be acting as a booster to my original shot as a kid. Is that true?
If Dave had never been exposed to measles, the one shot is good. It gives about 90% protection. The second shot, the booster, would bring that protection up to around 95%, maybe even higher than that. So with that one shot, Dave does have good protection. But I'm smiling with Dave's question because I'm in that same cohort that he's talking about, born before 1957, and the CDC said that you can just assume you got measles because almost everybody did. I caught measles from one of my patients when I was in my very early 30s. I assumed I'd had measles before, but I never had. So I think if don't just assume you've had measles if you were born before 1957, if you were born before the measles vaccine, really, to make sure you either have an immunity test, it's a simple blood test, or get what Dave got. His doctor was absolutely right. Another alternative is just get vaccinated again.
But I think Dave's question is specifically about a cohort who would have gotten vaccinated for measles as a child, but gotten an older version of the vaccine that was not as effective.
Okay, that vaccine was available between 63 and 68. So if that's the vaccine he got, then he should assume he was never vaccinated and get two more.
Just treat it as if you are totally naive.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. or tune in live to call in live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. And we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. If you can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.